Hi, Johan.
Hello.
What was your first computer?
Oh, my first computer was Commodore C64, way back in the day. I don't think I was very old at the time, but yeah, it was a great computer. You could like start doing things from the start. I mean, I remember I actually, of course, I used it to play games. But you had this instruction manual. So I remember that I just there were some examples at the back, like this, flying balloon or something like that. So I remember I just entered every word from the instruction manual into the console to get it working finally. So I think that was the start of my journey and interest in computers.
Mm-hmm. Do you actually know? I think C64, the origin company, was bought by a YouTube channel, right?
Yeah, I heard something about that. I'm not really sure, but yeah, I've heard something along those
and
lines.
And you can buy now a remake of the origin one.
I think. Oh, cool.
Yeah, there were always remakes, but now I think it's the a better remake.
I have one in the basement somewhere.
But not the new one. I think the new one is different. So
right,
I understood.
Right.
There was a new campaign in the summer, and it cost like 300 euros. I have to investigate that. So this was interesting stuff.
Yeah.
So what you're saying, you started playing with C64. Your first action with the computer was playing game, right?
Yeah, playing games, but also I remember because I wanted to understand a bit more. I remember when you were loading up the games from the tape, and you had to write some commands of course I don't remember it, but load eight comma something.
This was basic load command, at least on my C64. I think this was also on C64 at ZX. I guess in C64 is the same load. And I think you had to provide the name, and then you have to search on the tape, You have to
find
the silent spot, and then you started, and it loaded or not. This was what happened.
Yeah. So I think I was I wanted to understand what is this load thing, and what does it do? So I remember I don't remember much, but I remember that I was interested and I wanted to understand more.
Mm-hmm. And you understood a bit, or
not sure?
Yeah, exactly.
At least I tried.
I also tried, but it was no way. Actually, I was I don't know whether I was more confused than before, but it was way too sophisticated.
Yeah.
And what was your favorite game?
Oh, my favorite game on the C64? Mm-hmm. I don't remember. I actually don't remember, but no, I have to give it a pass.
What I remember is that there were magazines, and there was always short description of the games. So this is how I read a lot, but I didn't have a lot of games, but I read about the games. And Paperboy was a thing back then, you remember?
Yeah, it was. Paperboy? Yeah, yeah.
This was
I remember.
And because I try, to remember what I actually did. Uh-huh. When you started when you started do something different to gaming on the machine or on another machine?
No, I think maybe on the first PC that my parents bought. It was 486 SX25 with 4 megabytes of RAM. Mm-hmm. I did play games there as well, but it was quite slow. So I started to do other things, and I think that was the first computer that I started to do some. Well, basic coding, and maybe even before I used an Amiga 500.
Oh,
and we, machine. Yeah, and we used to make some me and some friends. We did some scripting kind of things, like demos and stuff like that. So maybe that was even before the PC era, I think.
Uh-huh.
I
assume this C64 was bought in Sweden, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it easy to get? Was it some esoteric thing, or you could just walk into a store?
No, I think it wasn't hard. It was all over the place. I think.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I thought thank this you, was like, man. You know, only specific stores is like, you know, it's like a common thing to buy a C64, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And was it expensive I think or, my friends, or not?
No, I don't think it was that expensive. We bought it secondhand, but I don't think it was that expensive.
Okay.
I didn't pay it myself. my parents did.
But comparing, you know, what interests me comparing to today's computer. So if you buy a laptop, is it a similar, you know, expense or?
It must have been much cheaper. I think.
Yeah, that is actually cool.
Yeah.
Because I thought back then, like, C64 was very expensive, like something, you know, alien technology. But I think it was not the case. So Okay, you had Amiga 500 because I wanted to buy Amiga 500. This was like for me like a crazy machine. So it was like the graphics were great and the sound was stellar. So you had one?
Yeah, Amiga 500 plus even.
Whoa, what is plus? I don't know what.
Yeah, I don't remember what the difference was, but I remember it was a plus.
Oh. And maybe you just was sticker, you know. You got
maybe could be.
You bought, you know, a tuning kit. There was just a sticker with the plus.
Yeah.
Everything ran smoother. And you started coding with Amiga or was gaming?
Well, I don't know if you can say coding, but yeah, we did this kind of scripts and demos, some boot disk or something, and you put it in the computer and then it booted up and you can have like this like demos. You saw like stars coming towards you.
Yeah, but
like,
this is heavy coding actually. Why you are not saying this is coding?
I don't know. I didn't like code in a programming language. It was like something similar to Bash or something like that.
Ah, so you're saying there were scripts, you know, to for the demo creation?
Yeah, if I remember it correctly, there was something along those lines. But we kind of used like small programs that with the stars that came at you, and then there were some other like small programs that you can use to have like text showing up on the screen going back and forth and stuff like that, and we like kind of composed that into some demos that we used for ourselves.
And you wanted to do what, Star Wars? A Star Wars.
Maybe. Yeah, no, Dark. not. I mean, demo in the like, there was kind of a like a demo scene. I mean, you know, I think that was more in the PC area, but we did it in Amiga as well. It was more like you played some background music and you showed some messages. Going back.
He had a chat with guests, and some of them were hardcore. So they did, you know, they implemented the entire thing in almost assembler to make it faster.
Cool.
Yeah. So the first time I heard that it was possible to do this with scripts, which is interesting.
Mm.
Okay, pretty cool. So you did this with the Amiga, and then you got PC. And what I remember is also my experience. So the first PCs, they were not about gaming at all. They were more like some... I had one that was a black and white. I don't know whether there was even, you know... the graphics were actually good enough to have games. So what I remember that the Amiga was way better than the PC, and the PCs were more for work, and they were also advertised that way on TVs, you know, those like I don't know, Office or whatever. And but they look professional, so they had proper keyboard and proper monitor. But then I think it started with 386 or something like this, and I had even one 8086.
All right.
I don't know whether there was a game on it, so I maybe it was. Yeah. Okay. And what you did with the PC?
Also a bit of gaming, but I think that's when I started doing some more like real programming, like in BASIC. And I remember I read books about Pascal. So I think back then, if there was such a thing for me as a favorite programming language, it was probably Turbo Pascal. So I did some things there. And also, I started to get a bit interested in assembler.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I did some like games. This was a long time ago, but some games were really easy to crack. I mean, you could just open the file in a something called the Win32 disassembler, and you could like look at the assembler code. And some games back then, they were really easy to, I mean, it was like, oh, you should enter like the code for the game in order to play it. But you just changed the assembler instruction from jump if equal to jump if not equal. And then you could play the game with the wrong code.
Yeah, this was also possible on ZX, but it was like with pick and no, it was also editor and with pick and pox as well. So you can stop the game and do something with pick will change the memory. But how you knew what to change?
Yeah,
you were you were able to reverse engineer the games back then?
No, it wasn't that hard. I think that you ran the game and then you somehow. Yeah, like you said, you interrupted it somehow at runtime, and then you saw the current instructions right before and after or something like that. And then you could just change, like, if I remember it correctly, you just maybe didn't change it at runtime, but you kind of edited the file, like, with Win32 disassembler. And you
because
changed
what I wanted to
happen
then sometimes is... more lives, right? So it's just not.
I'm not sure if I did that, but just like working around some very easy, like what's it called when you have to enter a code to play a game, like a registration.
The license.
Yeah, the license exactly. So stuff like that. But I also did that on the C64. We had like this, it was something called the final cartridge you could use to intercept the games. And then you could edit the memory and change like, I want more lives and things like that. So that
not
was
bad. So you were low level matrix hacker back then already.
I don't know.
Okay, cool. So Pascal. What you did with Pascal? Because I also had some Pascal experience, and what I appreciated is that you could actually create something which runs as a proper application. Because with Basic, for me, I didn't like that the source code everywhere, so you have to load it in somehow, and what I appreciate in Pascal, you get an app. So this is what I like.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I think I made some small games, I think. Like cool. Some 2D games where you had like a character, and you could like... Yeah, sort of kind of like something like Super Mario inspired thing.
Oh, okay.
I remember that was probably the most advanced thing that that I did. But also one thing that I liked with Pascal was that you could do inline assembler. So you could write like assembler code inside your Pascal program.
Yeah, almost GNI, right?
Yeah, I think so. But I think there was also a construct, if I remember correctly, that you could write not actually... assembly, you could write pure machine code, if I remember it correctly. It was like an inline thing, so you can write like really crazy stuff.
And you knew what cool. to write? So
no
okay.
But Google was not around, I think, back then, but you had to like try to look things up. And I read this was it a book or something, The Art of Assembly Programming or something like that.
Wow.
It was a book back in the day that I read.
So you liked low-level books?
I don't know. It seems so, in retrospect.
So I don't know whether I like books, but I knew I have to read them. So I read the books, and the first book I didn't got anything, so I couldn't understand anything. And then I read another book, and then after a few books, I knew what's going on. So this was my way. Of learning things.
Yeah, I think with Pascal, I remember I read a really, really thick book about Turbo Pascal. It had probably like 600 pages or so. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember reading that book on a vacation with my parents back in the day.
Yeah, this is a proper thing for vacations, right? In Sweden.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your parents like that, right? That you are reading computer books in vacations.
Yeah, probably.
Probably. They thought they maybe thought the Turbo Pascal is a kind of a game or something because it sounds like Turbo. Yeah, but what you did with that? So you did some the game, okay? But the game Were graphics involved? So it was somehow sophisticated?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sophisticated. It depends on what you compare with. But yeah, there were graphics, and you could like move around and collect points and jump over obstacles and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's, if I would compare it, I know there were lots of Super Mario-like games back then. So it was like an average game? Or was
yeah,
it...
I would say, I mean, probably less than average. I don't know, but it was just for, I wanted to play around and do things. I never
and you have
like.
Some testers? There were some users who used actually the game?
No, it was just me and a couple of friends.
Okay.
That were like messing around. So.
So you stick with games or started at one point of time to implement something else?
I think it was mostly games and I tried to do some of these like demo things. So it was mostly that, I think. I think so. I didn't do much else.
And when you switched language, so you had a Turbo Pascal, what was your next language?
Yeah, Turbo Pascal, then I think maybe what could it be? Maybe some C or C++. But then maybe it was actually Java. That was the main next language.
Wow! And how you found Java back then? So what was what initiated the switch from Turbo Pascal to Java?
I think that was in school actually that we were introduced to Java. Mm-hmm. And then I've been using Java ever since as my more
you
or
say
less main
school is like before you before university it was like
I think we did play around with it a bit in is it high school I don't know but before university but at university we used Java as the main language.
So you studied computer science?
Yeah.
Cool. And where? Yeah. In Malmö?
No, first it was in a place called Blekinge for a couple of years, and then I moved to Lund University, which is close to Malmö.
Okay, cool.
So
and was it hard to study computer science? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit hard. Lots of math and things like that. But it was like... I mean, I've always been mainly interested in programming. So in hindsight, maybe I should have picked something that was, just more focused on just programming and software development. But so this was a bit more broad, this education.
Yeah.
I don't regret it. But maybe it took like 3 years or something like that until you could like focus on the more software development kind of things. In the education, but no, it was nice.
And what was the first Java program, maybe a bigger one, besides Hello World?
First Java, I don't know actually. I don't think outside of school, I didn't do any open source stuff and things like that when I was in school. But that started. When I started working, like my first real job.
This is after the university you started. What was your first task or your first job?
My first job was I got employed by a company called Jway, consultancy firm based on Sweden. And
I think I was invited to them or something. Jway, it comes.
It's not impossible at all. It was a really great company.
Yeah.
Lots of, really good people there and very knowledgeable people. So I learned a lot quite fast. My first project was in consultancy at IKEA. With a couple of other people from Jway, they actually I'm very glad that I had the first assignment with those people because they were really into they were heavy Spring users even back then. That this was 2005, and they were really into like automated testing and yeah, and things like that. So that really inspired me, and I think, yeah, I kind of have them to thank for showing me that this was an interesting thing, and several of the open source stuff that I have been doing have been focused around software testing that they kind of introduced, we had other things in school, but they were very rigorous with testing right from the start. So that was cool.
So IKEA uses Java.
Yeah, they at least the parts where I used to work, yeah, they were heavy Java users and EGB users as well. But the team that I was in, we were not using EGBs. We were kind of a little bit on the side. Mm-hmm. And we were exploring some other ways of doing things.
And where you ran, on which runtime?
That I don't remember.
Was it a JBoss, Tomcat?
White Probably Tomcat. I would guess Tomcat, but I don't remember. Mm-hmm. Really, yeah.
Because why I'm asking is, what I never understood back then is they thought, okay, the application servers were too heavy. And then they use Spring and run Spring on application servers, which make the entire thing even heavier than what I had. Because in my project, I used I was a huge EJB fan, but what I use from EJBs is basically one annotation stateless, and I could inject them, and it was done. And this was small and fast. And Spring.
Yeah, I don't think, if I remember it correctly, I don't think like this at stateless thing even exists. We didn't have annotations even back then. I mean, this was old style EGB that most people were using.
Okay.
Like, there was really, really heavy EGB.
Okay, this
so, then so what Spring you was used? Spring was very lightweight, I think, compared to the old school EGB.
So. Regarding the history, so the old school EJB, I think they stopped in 2005 because then Java E5 came out. And the first one was a bit crazy because you had home interface, you had local or remote interface, and the bean.
Exactly.
And they there was no relation between the interfaces. You only have to implement the right signature. Mm-hmm. And you could, of course, use an interface, a proper interface, and then you had four parts. Local, then the home, the business interface, and the bean, and then XML, which holds everything together. Yeah. And as Spring came out, Spring had usually interface, implementation, and an XML file.
Yeah.
But Java E5 was released, and then the annotations were introduced.
Yeah.
And then I could completely remove the XML, which was for me. I hated the XML because I had to edit the XML and the Java code. I had to keep them in sync. This was the problem. So what I did back then is I generated with X.docklet the entire thing from a Java class. So I had the Java class with JavaDoc annotations, and all the interface and everything was generated. I hated the generation, but I didn't have to at least keep everything in sync.
Yeah.
And what I did never understood, because there were Spring architects back then, or users who really believe that XML is good and they can achieve something and decouple, the implementation from the interface, but I never saw it in action. So I saw project like interface impulse millions of times and nothing was changed, and they still had the XML. And then Java 6 came out and there was even more conventions. And what I remember as well, Spring didn't like the annotations. They told, okay, this auto-wired or whatever it was called is not for production, because in production they would like to explicitly set the configuration in XML. And for me, I always said, one class, usually no interfaces. I injected what I had and I was done. So this is why I always curious what they try to achieve and how they are thinking back then. Because it was like always modularity, but nothing was modular. And I was like, okay, then show me what you did, or a high testability, and they didn't test. You are the exception. Okay, we can talk about tests, but then we have to write the test. We cannot just talk. And this is why I'm asking, because it was crazy times. And as I said, the best was they said, okay, EGBs are too heavy, and they run Spring inside application server, and then you had both, both worlds in one thing. So this was the crazy times back then.
Yeah, I think if I remember it correctly, I mean, to be, I don't think Tomcat was an actual application server, right? Because an
It was just
application
Summit
server,
Engine, yeah.
yeah, exactly. So yeah, I don't know, but yeah, I remember back then there was a heavy use of XML for sure, and I think the rationale was yeah, kind of was what you were implying that you should like yeah separate the. Yeah, the interface from the
Yeah.
implementation, and we wire them together using XML so
Yeah,
that
and
they're
the
not
problem
coupled
was if
in
you
the
reviewed
code.
the projects back then, it was obvious how they wired together because I remember they had even strange, this is also another naming convention, like there was interface and the IMPL was called IMPL because there was never a second one. So, okay, but if you do this, why need the XML? Because you can just, pick convention and throw away the XML. This is just strange. Yeah, this was strange times back then, I remember.
But I think there was also some of these stuff were like technical concerns, I think. Like for example, this is why I started this PowerMock project back in the day as well, because some things you couldn't like well, people said that you couldn't test them, but you obviously you could actually test them. But what they meant was that you couldn't mock certain things. Because of how the implementation was written, perhaps like with if you wanted to have the some final method or something like that, you should always code against interfaces because then you can mock the interface methods and so on. So
So
I
you
think
started
some of these
PowerMock back
things.
then.
Me and a colleague at the J-Way, Johan Kronqvist, we started it a long time ago.
And caused by the IKEA project.
Not sure, but inspired in some sense by the
Inspired, yeah.
inspired because yeah, this was yeah, like I said, like people and also at conferences. I mean, people were talking about testing and stuff like that, and they said, "Oh, you should never use static methods, for example, because you can't test them." And I was really curious. I mean, what do you mean when you say you can't test them? And what they meant was that you can't mock them like easily. But I mean, of course, you can test them. I think static methods are the easiest methods to test. Yeah, then I think my colleague Jan Kronqvist, he started experimenting with AspectJ and to do yeah to mock static methods. And then we teamed up and ported his code to what was it called? JavaAssist, bytecode manipulation library.
The AspectJ was also a strange vehicle back then. So I had yes during the workshop I also told the story because I was invited in a conference and I was supposed to do an interview with the AspectJ. This was Edwin Collier, I think. Yeah, and for me, I couldn't get proper use cases. So I mean, the use cases everyone talk about was logging, caching, and the third one, security.
Yeah,
But they were
security.
already part of the application servers back then. So okay, I put annotation, I have the transactions. I put another annotation, I have the security. And I asked, what else? And the answers were always, okay, we can modularize the cross-cutting concerns and we'll keep them separate from the main business logic. I said, give me an example. Which concerns do you still have? And there was no examples. And the crazy thing in Germany, there were conferences, talks about AspectJ without actually talking about real-world usage. And interestingly, recently on this podcast, I had a chat with Lambda Power Tools. And the reason why I try to avoid Lambda Power Tools is because of the AspectJ dependencies. And there's lots of and the problem is it's not even maintained right now. So the AspectJ is out of fashion completely. And I'm still not sure. What were the big use cases? So I have to find someone who say, okay, we use AspectJ and it really paid out because this and this were better in our project. What I absolutely understand, if you are building runtimes or application servers, AspectJ was great because all your runtimes and platforms, application servers are all about aspects. But in the business logic code in a project like your IKEA project and my other projects, I never saw a use case for AspectJ. So it was for me as a huge amount of complexity and zero, literally zero added value in my projects, right?
Yeah, no, I think I agree. I actually saw a good demo from a colleague. Unfortunately, this was a long time ago, but he used it to implement actually some domain specific things.
This would be cool, you know. So, like, you know, the killer domain cases when to use AspectJ. This would be cool because I tried to find something and it is hard. And the worst case is if you have such a thing, it is not visible to developers. So you have actually document. Look, your business logic is not directly called. There is some magic in between. It's also hard to understand, you know, if you're new in a
Yeah,
project.
there are probably, I mean, unfortunately, I don't remember, I mean, his cases, but I mean, today I would most likely think of another solution that would work like probably or hopefully just as well without the technical difficulties.
And what always makes me think is if you know the entire community would says this is the way to go, and I don't understand it. It's like this is, and then I find to find other developers who also doesn't understand this, and then maybe we can clarify something like this, because it's like, okay, if everyone says this is the thing and no one can tell, you know, how to use it, then if something is, and this is, what I appreciate about the time right now is this is more reasonable, right? If you do one thing and then explain, it's okay, but it's not like technology is hyped like crazy, and this is maybe over. So we have enough experience in Java at least, so it doesn't happen. My feeling is the other languages right now are repeating our errors or problems and misconceptions because they are crazy about patents and whatever we did in Java. I hear now in JavaScript, whatever, the same terms. Like, okay, interesting what happens there, right?
Yeah, sure. No, but
Do you have the
I also
impression
think,
that
I mean,
Java code is getting leaner and leaner and no magic, and the other languages are going more the magic route right now?
no,
No, because if you
no, I
look at
don't.
my code, Java 25, really, it looks like, you know, JDK 1.1, very simple without the bloat.
Yeah, and
And
that's really nice, but I'm not sure if I've noticed that in like other languages taking a different route. I mean, I'm a bit like interested in programming languages as well.
For instance,
So,
consider JavaScript and NPM. So NPM is like Maven on steroids. They completely exaggerated the modularity. So they have even, you know, a single methods or modules. And I remember, so 2006, as Maven well, came to Maven 2 became more popular. So I was in project where developers loved, you know, to create Maven modules. There were hundreds of Maven modules. Like, you're all crazy. Why are you doing this? And then they had the problems. They have to release the modules, version the models. It was impossible. So everything was snapshot. So I go, okay, if everything is snapshot, why you need so many modules? And my impression is this is now repeated in Python or Node.js. I tried to install something with Python. There were hundreds of modules. I say, okay, what happens here, right? And in Java, what do you do? In my projects, we have a very few modules actually. And I really enjoy this. So, like, okay, I don't have to justify. I have one module monolith. I can even call it monolith and nothing happens. You know, 5 years ago, everything has to be a mo no, 5, 10 module. You remember the OSGI hype? Yeah, for
I worked
instance.
with OSGI, yeah.
Okay. And now it's over. I mean, there are only reasonable OSGI projects remained, but not everything has to be OSGI, right?
No, yeah. I mean, I really like Maven because I mean some people don't like it, but it's so stable. I mean, it was a few years back. I remember I opened a really, really old project. I mean, more than 10 years. I haven't touched it in 10 years, and I opened it, and everything just worked. I mean Java continued to work. Maven continued to work. Everything is built, which is quite amazing if you think about it. I remember I opened like a 3-year-old Node project at some occasion. Nothing worked. I mean, I couldn't. Yeah, I couldn't get it working, and I really tried, but was too much had changed, and I really like that stability aspect of
I
it.
also like Maven, but what I don't like about Maven sometimes right now I create a small JavaScript, So, you know, some automation scripts with Java. And this is, then is Maven too heavy. Because, you know, you need like the Shader, I think, plugin, which creates the jar, which is executable. So I implemented a simplistic tool for me, so it just creates an executable jar, no dependencies. But if you have a few dependencies, Maven is great. I mean, I use Maven all the time, and I don't need any specific Maven plugins, just dependency management, and it's great, right? This is and for simple projects, Maven isn't faster than Gradle. It's interesting.
No, but I kind of like that. I mean, because my impression from like Gradle and things like that is that I mean I like Gradle as well, but it's sometimes too easy to make custom stuff, because it is easy to make custom stuff. And
yeah, this is what Gradle is for, right? You can code the build process, which I don't like.
Yeah, exactly. But this is my kind of my point. And one thing that I like with Maven, it has some like opinionated stuff. And then there are, I mean, people have written gazillions of plugins. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, there's already someone else that have solved your problem, and you can use that instead of like writing your own stuff that you have to maintain throughout the years.
Yeah.
So I kind of like that with Maven. You have to like think one more time before you do stuff.
What I try to achieve with Maven is I try not to use any plugins in Maven. And if there is something automation to do, I try to do it in CI/CD pipeline, for instance. So Maven just, you know, dependency management, and that's basically it. And I also try to reduce the amount of external dependencies. And then if there is something to automate, I do it before and after, not with Maven, rather than with whatever available in the CI/CD pipeline.
Yeah.
Cool. So now back to the Power Mock, because it was also very popular back then. And and I also remember it's not static, it's more like singletons. So people hated singletons because of testing, and they said, okay, we cannot easily mock it because if it's set, it's set, right? This was the problem. And with Power Mock, you can still do this, right?
Yeah, you can do you could do a lot of stuff with Power Mock.
So how it worked with AspectJ, and what was then the Java assist? So
No, we never used AspectJ for Power Mock. We used the ASM and Java assist, and so we created our custom class loaders. And when the class were loaded, we manipulated the classes, just removed final, and did some other things to allow mocking up static methods. And you could do more things. There was actually kind of a little API where you could like replace a method with another method. So it was just like some Java, small Java API for like, just replaced. And then a method reference with another reference with the same signature. That was quite cool. But,
wow, it's like almost method injection.
Yeah, something like that.
How hard was it? How long?
It was quite hard. I mean, we used all the magic tricks that we could find. And we also integrated, because it was really tightly integrated with the because PowerMock built on top of Mockito and EasyMock, and also JUnit and TestNG. And we had to hook in to various places. And back then, like, there weren't any good hooks for us to hook in. So we had a really, really tight coupling between like every minor version of Mockito. When they changed something, we had to change PowerMock for things to keep on working. And also the same thing applied to EasyMock. And JUnit and stuff like that. I remember I did some really, really crazy things during the Christmas break once in PowerMock for JUnit. I did like a custom JUnit runner that each JUnit method were executed in a different class loader, and then the results were merged back into the original class loader. But
this is almost like application server in wars back then. Yeah. There was like, you know, the platform class loader.
Exactly. So that was really tricky. I remember there were a lot of modules as well in PowerMock. One module is this class loader deep cloner thing that can clone an entire object graph from one class loader into another, even though the original class loader is not a parent of the other class loader. So a lot of those crazy things.
Yes, but this sounds like fun. So you learn a lot. And,
I learned a lot. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It was really cool that you, this is not your typical day-to-day Java job that you do in PowerMock.
Mm-hmm. PowerMock has still 4,000 stars on GitHub, which is a lot.
Yeah, that's probably a lot. I mean, I don't think it's maintained anymore. There was another person, Arthur Sagritinov or something like that, who took over it a couple of years back, and he did some amazing things, but he has also left the project, so I think it's more or less dead.
And you were very active in 2014 around.
Yeah, I was pretty active. It wasn't on GitHub at first. It was on Google. What was it called? Google Code. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. In several years. So I was very active from, 2007 to, I don't know when I stopped really, but some maybe mm-hmm. 2014. I don't know.
And the Arthur Sagritinov, and this is the king of nothing.
Exactly. GitHub. Exactly. He was great. Yeah. He was great.
He now works for JP Morgan, actually. Yeah.
Looking okay. Mm-hmm. Now he did a lot of things. So we had some really, as you can imagine, some really tricky bugs, and he managed to actually fix a lot of them. He was really good. Mm-hmm. And really, we had some really strange stuff going on in our class loader that we didn't understand. But I think that he managed to solve. Some of those things.
You remember what strange things? Is it just no some.
No, it was some. No, I don't remember off the top of my head. But it was like for certain classes, some things didn't really work the way we expected. It was some really unfortunately, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. And what interests me? So you got the idea. So you wanted to replace or mock. This is mocking means replacing with fake stuff. So what I can imagine, so you wanted to start PowerMock and say, okay, there is a static field and I would like to replace the contents of the final static with something else. This is the first use case, right?
Yes, exactly.
And how long it took until it worked? How many hours or days?
We got some. It wasn't that hard to get some, the basic stuff working, but
the basic stuff. Quite a while. So was it day two?
Something I don't know, a couple of hours maybe to get the initial thing working. But we wanted to not. Our goal was not to create a completely new thing, because we were using, I don't think Mockito existed back in the day. It was EasyMock that was very popular. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to build something on top of EasyMock. So that also complicated things, because we wanted to kind of hook into their way of working.
So you always wanted to be integrated with Mockito?
Not this Mockito, because Mockito didn't exist, but EasyMock at first. EasyMock at first, and then when Mockito got released, we also did support for Mockito. So
before Mockito, there was EasyMock, and there was another framework. This was a German one where you have to record stuff in advance. So mm-hmm. and then it was a little bit more complicated, and it was hugely popular in Germany. It was Mockito. I look it up because I'm interested.
Yeah, I'm also interested.
Because Mockito was really nice. But before Mockito, JMocket, PowerMox.
Ah, exactly. JMocket was also, they were in a similar vein as PowerMock, I think. Mm-hmm. But they were they were not building on top of other existing projects like we were trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And I think EasyMock or JMock, it's one of them, they were very popular in Germany. But, in order mock something, to mock something, it was a lot to do. So this is, you have to record. It's like, you're all crazy. I will never do this. Regardless how nice. No. And then Mockito came out.
Yeah.
And Mockito was different. So I like Mockito from the start because it was like when then and you're done, basically.
Yeah.
And then I use Mockito for everything. So if it was necessary because... I ignore the others completely. So I say, okay, maybe, but it was like Black Magic. No, not Black Magic. It was very verbose. This was the problem. Genau, record and replay. This was the easy mock record and replay.
Yeah, that was easy mock, exactly.
Easy mock.
Exactly.
I never liked that. And J-Mocket, I have to look it up, whether I look at this. But Mockito, I remember, it was since maybe 2008. Mockito is around, something like this. And
Something like that.
Yeah, and I started to use it all the time, actually.
Yeah, me too. I gradually moved from easy mock to Mockito. A lot of happened since then, and you always learn new things. So nowadays, I try not to use mocks at all if I don't.
Same here. Have to. So I didn't want it to mention that because I try to completely avoid mocks, and even worse, what I also try not to do is if I work in a cloud environment, I try to use the cloud environment all the time, and don't try to start anything locally. And this works good for me, and this is because it's always not a question if you're testing. What do you try to test? Is this like, are you testing your business logic, which in my project was not, I mean, the real problem, but I always struggled with the infrastructure, whatever it was, you know, application servers, timeouts, deadlocks. Certificates, containers, permissions, even on OpenShift permissions, and now cloud permissions. And for me, this takes long to resolve or to fix, and not necessarily my business logic. So I think the entire Java community optimized testing in the wrong direction, maybe. And what I also saw is that developers always try to build their own local isolated thing, with branching, with local stacks or whatever, and then it was always painful to integrate this stuff with other developers, right? So this is, and my dream is always, we have a crazy fast CI/CD pipeline, we push something, in the next second is production, right? This would be the ideal. So of course, it's not achievable, but this is what we should strive for.
Right? Have you looked at the Dart lang? That's...
Dart or Dark?
Dark, like no. Dark. No, you should. I've never used it, but they at least claim to you can deploy stuff to production like in sub-second. So it's the CI/CD and stuff like that. Everything is built into I'm not sure if it's built into the language itself, but at least it's built built into the experience when you're working with the language.
Interesting concept. Dark lang, I will look at this because,
So maybe that's something you like.
I like the concept already. Whether it is now viable for my projects, I don't know. But the idea that, we should optimize in like dark lang, to be as fast as possible in production or integration, whatever you choose. Production is production, something visible in production, like environment. This is for me production. And not necessary to replicate the entire production in a developer machine and then, you know, be afraid to push to GitHub because then integration will break, right?
I agree. But I also think that, I try to structure my code in a way that to represent business logic to the greatest not to the greatest extent possible. It depends on the case as well, but I kind of like that if you have some complex business logic and you try to implement that in a simple way and to avoid infrastructure in that kind of code branch, I think that can be really nice to think about that kind of separation, because not only I think it can be easy to reason about, but also it's much easier and faster to test.
But it is always given right now in the modern Java projects, because if I remember now, just recap my recent project. So Quarkus and JAX-RS. So it means we have one entry point, which is HTTP polluted. So there is path, get, post, and response and JSON. And this is one class. And the next class has nothing to do with JAX-RS. So so we inject an OD boundary, and this is just pure pure business logic. So a harder case is AWS Lambda without Quarkus, so it's just Java class, and it gets you know a JSON event from AWS. So this is like specific event. So what I do there is like entry point, and the next method gets a JSON, and it tries you know to convert the JSON to a Java record, and starting with that, everything pure business logic. And a little bit harder is if you have something like workflow engine, like step functions, because then you really depend on the thing. And then you also have to test it. So in this particular case, I would rather you know have a test account, whatever, to test the step functions because before I try to mock them. Because
I'm not talking about mocking. Like testing.
Or testing locally, or try to replicate. I don't know how to call it. There's a local stack.
I understand what you mean.
Simulating the real one.
Yeah, locally. Simulating. Yeah, but I think that also some. I mean, where mocks can be good sometimes. Like for example, if I take a real world example, sometimes if you run into some really like. Corner case kind of things with some database transactions or stuff like that. You want to simulate like a specific error and to really make sure that your code maybe this happens sometime due to a bug or something in production and you want to really simulate it, and it's really tricky to simulate it in other ways than to use a mock. Then I think that still is a good case for a mock.
Absolutely.
Simulate certain error messages.
Just a simple case where you have some business logic less calculations which access the database. So what you can do with the mock, just replace the method of the and this is called spy, I think, in Mockito, right? So where you can replace just one method, not the entire class, which returns your thing, and then you can test your calculations without the database. But I know where you're going. So what you could also do, you can write a pure Java class which gets the data from outside, and then you don't have to use no mock at all, because you can just call the class or call the method, and you're basically done.
Exactly. So I tend to like that approach where you kind of like this doesn't. You need to do some tricks sometimes, depending on how much data and stuff like that there is. But if you like, you gather your data in some kind of infrastructure kind of thing
before.
Before, yeah. So you gather data, and when you have your data, you send that to your domain function or whatever it
is.
And you return some updated state or something, and then you can store that instead of going haywire all over the place in your domain logic to maybe call out to databases or other services and stuff like that. You can do that. From the outside, you can pass in higher order functions, for example, if you want to have them to be lazy and stuff like that. So, and that makes it much easier to test without mocks, even. And but I also think, I mean, my personal take is that I want to have most tests. I mean, if possible, like in this, I wanted to have them fast and like a pure-ish like domain model, but. We usually use like test containers and stuff like that. So we have some tests that tests the entire thing. I mean, of course, it will be like it won't be the actual environment, but from my experience, it's usually good enough to spin up these containers. Yeah.
Unit test fast. I'm absolutely with you. And less magic, as you said. You can actually. Just instantiate the class, and what I do with the logic right now in Java records actually perfect for that. So you can have a Java record, you can add to the Java record the entire state you need, and the Java records can have absolutely business logic in them with methods, and you can call them. So this is one of the tricks. Another trick is actually interfaces with static methods. So in my serverless, so I go, why I don't need dependency injection, I don't need POJOs, nothing. I just need functions, methods. And this is sometimes a good, just to have, you know, very simple static methods, and you pass this whatever you like, is super testable, and you returns, and you're done.
Yeah. Now, I also, I even like to take things a bit further, because I was quite into Clojure before, the programming language. And I think that's a great programming language to, how do you say, to widen your perception, I think. And Rich Hick, I think, is the author of Clojure. He was, I think, he's quite famous for trying to, like, decouple a state from behavior and identity. So I usually don't have, like, a business logic inside my records. I think of records as, well, records as, like, pure, like, pure data. And then I'd like to have some, I mean, in Java, I would prefer to have, like, my business functions. They can be static functions. It's and you just, like, pass the state to the function, and it returns like an updated state.
So you could also do this. What you are saying is you have a Java record which is passed to interface, which is static, and then the functions.
Yeah, perform. It doesn't have to be an interface. It can be a class with static methods.
Yeah, a method, and, whatever you have. Just but I think why class with static methods? Interface is better.
Why?
Why? Because class can have state and interface with
But not if not it can't have state if you if all your method well you can of course but if all the methods are static.
Then I see in the project the strange things that developers create a private constructor just to prevent the creation of the class.
And also I mean why do you need a class? I mean if you want to take things further like for I use Kotlin many times and also like in Clojure you don't have. Well, of course, in Kotlin you have classes, but I mean, if you could just put the methods directly in a package, I mean, I wouldn't even need to use.
In Java it's impossible, but what you do in Java, interface with static methods. This is why I don't use classes rather than interfaces.
Because it's
because if you think about this, you cannot instantiate interface. It is shorter, and works perfectly.
But what you can always instantiate an interface, right?
Or interfaces you can never instantiate an interface because interfaces.
Oh no, no, of course no. But you can create like I mean, they are
anonymous in a class or whatever.
Yeah,
you could do this, but if you have a Java class with static methods, you can just instantiate the class, and this is pointless. This is like misleading, you know. But
There are some workarounds, of course. Like you said, you can have private constructors, and you can make the class final and stuff like
that. Yeah, but you can do this, but there's lots of plumbing, and then Johan will join the podcast and will say, okay, Java is verbose. I do Kotlin. So in my case, my Java is shorter, right? The cool thing. With Java, if you apply these tricks or tricks, is this just you use what's there? It is surprisingly, I would say, concise and maintainable.
I agree. I mean, especially
and with the Java record, with modern... I would disagree because why not consider specific? Not always, because you can say Java records can be data carriers. Then they are. Mm. There is no business logic, but they can also have behavior. Why not? They are immutable. You create one, there's behavior,
You could of course do that, but I think of it more like there are different concerns. You have your state. I want to make like this. This is the state. This is like explicitly the state, and then I want to have the behavior. That is something different. I want to like decouple the state from the behavior.
But why? There should be some advantage or what do you gain? Because if you just decouple of the sake of decoupling, then you will write more code. But sometimes,
I'm not sure if you write more code necessarily. But I think that this is like the philosophy that I more and more embrace from Clojure. To try to model these things separately. I mean, I'm not really sure. What would you gain to have them in the same place? I mean.
Okay, then a little bit example from the past, long time ago.
Yeah.
And what we had, this is my observation. What we had to model was a network.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a network of connected devices.
Mm-hmm.
And the devices had various capabilities, and the links between the devices had also various capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So now, if you model this with Java, you can say you have node and connection between nodes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just abstract classes, let's say, or interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
So, and now, if the the connection between the devices is fiber channel, so it there is a class which inherits from mm-hmm. from the connection as fiber channel, and it comes with
what is fiber channel? Do you mean like fibers, like, or is this a domain concept, or is it like
fiber channel is like a fast connection? It's like, you know, not a wire, it's like fiber, you know, like
yeah, I know about the concept, but do you actually mean like the technical, like a fiber,
the technical
thing?
Fiber channel, yeah, and right, there was a right, fiber it was not fiber channel, but this was like this, and the other one would be a wire connection or whatever, but the point is there are several inherited instances or classes from the connection with various capabilities.
Yeah.
So they said, okay, and if the signal was sent from device to device, depending on the instance, there was different behavior. And now the beauty happened because everything was stored in the database. You got the first device out and asked the device, hey, you know, give me the, I don't know, latency, whatever, if you talk to the other device. And device went to the connection, got the connection without knowing what kind of connection is. Ask the connection, what's your bandwidth? And the fiber channel said, this is my bandwidth. And this was based on some other attributes. And this was very, very simple. And there was another architect in the same project. And he tried to separate things. And this was hell on earth. Because what you had to do is you had to kind of pattern matching. You had to know what type is it and then ask, you know, about the type in all the places. So if something changes, we had to know to find all. This was not really good.
Isn't this the expression problem that you're
maybe. I don't know whether this is such a name, but I'm just a Java developer. So I don't know how this is called in other languages. But but the point is, I was in a project with Smalltalk people, and they had a feeling for that, and this was great because they hated Java, but they knew about object orientation, and I like Java, and I helped them to, and in the end they actually liked Java a bit more maybe, but the point is our code was simple. Was very very simple, and the other side.
Yeah, that's the most important thing, I think. I mean, I agree with you in that sense. I mean, of course, you shouldn't like decouple things for the sake of decoupling. I mean, it should. I mean, simple is also like maybe an overloaded term, but I think you should have a trade-off between simplicity and. And how do you say, like, easiness? Like, it should be easy to...
But simple, in my... What I understand under simple is, let's say you were, like, the domain experts of devices in the project. So, and if you look at the code, it should be recognizable to you what you're actually building. Then it's simple, right?
So, I'm using more, like, the definition, as I understand it, from Rich Hickey. Mm-hmm. And he has this famous talk, Simple Made Easy, I think. Mm-hmm. It's a very good talk. So I think, like, simple, now from what I understand, it's actually when you have broken things apart and they are, like, in its most simple form, like, like this is like, this is one thing that belongs together. You don't couple it with anything else. And then easy is more like... more like familiarity. So for example, closure can be really like hard to understand for people that are not used to it. So it may not be easy for them, but you could argue that it's simple. Like that could be a difference. So just to say one quick word, like what you're describing here, I mean, you can do similar things, if I understood your example correctly, like in closure and other languages, there's something called the multi-methods. There is a construct in other languages that you could use. I mean, this is not available in Java, as far as I know. I mean, I know that it's not available in Java, but in some libraries, I'm sure that there are some implementations of that. But yeah, there are all the constructs from other languages, and I think it's really like it's really interesting to take ideas from other places and learn new things. And I think that makes you, well, of course, yeah, it's a cliche, obviously, but yeah, you become better as a coder to look outside.
What you should not do, I think, is to religiously, you know, follow one pattern. Rather, you know definitely what's possible, and depending on project, you can apply this and this or mix of this. This then it works.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect.
No, I agree. Yeah.
I have to reinvite you back because what I would like to talk about, what you don't like about Java. So, and I try, you know, to find maybe or interesting concepts from other languages and try to, how to solve them with Java. This would be, you know, whatever. So, I'm just spend all my time with Java, and maybe, you know, something I'm missing out. I say, okay, if I would have closure, I will complete the project twice as fast or whatever. And you have a lots of small project awaitability, for instance, and you have the event sourcing with cloud events. Yeah. So you have a lots of small stuff, which is really interesting. Yeah. So there's a lot to talk.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about those. I mean, Occurrent, which is my event sourcing library, that's where my main interest is at the moment.
Then we have to talk about that. It also looks really, really nice.
Yeah, I've actually tried to take some of these ideas that we just discussed here and to apply it to the more event sourcing domain. And
About event sourcing next time. Where can people find you this time?
I'm on X. I don't write much there. I mainly just tweet when I make releases of my stuff. I very rarely say anything else. So I guess that's the main thing. And maybe GitHub, Johan Holleby, my first and last name.
Holleby, okay.
Yeah,
perfect. And now I had the chance to talk to a PowerMod creator.
Yeah, and I got the chance to talk to you. That's awesome.
Thank you. It was actually lots of fun. And see you next time.
See you. Take care.